Hello and welcome to a new season of the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Rob McNeil.
And I'm Jackie Broadhead.
So Jackie, today I've been asking the questions, but I've been asking the questions about a project that you obviously know very well because you lead it, which is the Understanding Migrant Destitution Project, which is run by the Global Exchange on Migration and Diversity here at Oxford University. And we've had a very, very interesting conversation about no recourse to public funds, the no recourse to public funds system, and the role of this in really making life very difficult for a lot of migrants. But let me start by asking you, why would there be a problem with limiting people's access to public funds? I mean, it seems, as a journalist, my immediate presumption would be, well, you have to have some kind of limits in place because you can't just provide people who've arrived in the country with immediate access to everything. Otherwise, you're creating a situation where you are presumably encouraging people to migrate for the purposes of accessing welfare. What is the problem with that?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I think lots of countries choose to have restrictions on access to their welfare systems, in particular, as you say, for kind of short-term arrivals. And the UK is no exception, and that's primarily the function of the no recourse to public funds system. But there are a couple of things that are quite particular to the NRPF system that really make it kind of more tricky. So I think there is a case of saying, actually, there's a lot of people who are coming to the UK. So I think it's about 2.6 million people now that are subject to the NRPF condition who are totally self-sufficient. So quite often in this project, we're talking to social workers. Quite a lot of international social workers will have leave to remain with NRPF. But it would also include, you know, Premier League footballers, investment bankers, etc. And actually having a system where you say there are limits on your access to the welfare safety net. I think, you know, there is a case to be made for that. But there are some problems. The first is the what happens when things go wrong question. So the presumption that is made in a lot of the legislation is that people will return to their country of origin. That basically, if something goes wrong and you would, and then, you know, you lose your job, you have health difficulties, whatever, you'll return. And that's not always possible, particularly if we're not talking about short-term migrants, but we're talking about people who've been here for a long time. So one of the recommendations within NRPF is to limit the amount of time, because it really applies for a very long amount of time for a lot of people. Actually, at that point, they might have had children here, they might be in relationships, they've kind of built their lives here. So there's this question of kind of temporary versus kind of longer term residency. The second is that actually we have a lot of conditionality built into the mainstream welfare system. So we don't have very many kind of universal welfare benefits. They're conditional based on meeting certain criteria for housing, for example, or for universal credit. And those would apply exactly the same to migrants. So you would already have restrictions for migrants, even if you got rid of the no recourse to public funds category. You still wouldn't be having people getting those things if they had very high incomes, for example, in exactly the same way as you would for kind of UK residents. So some of that has kind of become moot as the UK welfare system has become more restrictive. What the UK has also decided to do that we hear a lot about in the podcast is to devolve this system to local government, say, oh, we have a safety net, it's at local government, but give them absolutely no money to run it at a time when they're in real kind of financial dire straits. So we have this kind of technical safety net, and we've done a lot of research to kind of understand that safety net, but it's really kind of hobbled and it's dysfunctional. So the argument would be, well, if you are going to do it this way, then you should kind of fund it properly and make it function decently.
Okay, so one of the other things that I think is really important in the conversation that we've just been having is about the role of peer researchers. We've been speaking to a lady called Anne, who is somebody who has experience with the NRPF condition, and who is working with the Understanding Migrant Destitution Project to help actually undertake interviews with people and do all the various things that we need to do in order to understand how the system's affecting people. Can you just elaborate a bit more about what the purpose of having peer researchers is?
Yeah, absolutely. So for this project, we wanted, Compass had done a piece of research in 2015 that had looked at What are the numbers around this system? Like, how many people are supported? How much does it cost local authorities? And then what is the impact on people? And one of the things that are done through that is kind of interviews and focus groups. But one of the things that we really want to develop within Compass and within the Global Exchange is nothing about us without us. So having research methods that include those voices of lived experience. And the reasons for that are not only about kind of improving our research. So I think Anne talks about it in our interview of the kind of levels of trust that you have in having quite personal conversations with researchers who haven't gone through that versus people who have direct lived experience. But also we wanted to improve the research questions that we were asking and the type of recommendations that we were making by drawing on different types of expertise. So we're able to bring our kind of academic perspective and understanding of the research literature. We're also able to bring some work that we've done with kind of policymakers and professionals, understand, you know, what does government think about this? But there was a kind of missing piece, is kind of what do the people who are actually impacted by this policy? How did they understand it? How did they navigate it? And having community researchers was both about building trust so that we can get better answers to the questions that we have. But it was also about shaping what those questions are, making sure that we're asking the right questions so that we can get the best answers.
Excellent. Well, I think that on that note, we should probably pause our chat and introduce our guests for today. Today, I'm very grateful to be joined by Rupinder Paha, who's a specialist in NRPF issues in local government in London, and who's also worked on the issue for NGOs, by Lucy Leon, who's a researcher for the Global Exchange on Migration and Diversity, which is based here at the Centre on Migration Policy and Society at Oxford University, and by Anne, who is a peer researcher, an expert by experience, on the Understanding Migrant Destitution Project, which is also run here at Compass. I'm going to start with you, Lucy, if that's okay. So can I start by asking you to explain what this term NRPF actually means, who it affects, and why that matters?
So NRPF is no recourse to public funds. It's a Home Office immigration policy that essentially restricts migrants from accessing mainstream benefits, so basically excluding them from the welfare safety net. In terms of who it affects, we've seen a significant increase in the number of people impacted by the policy in recent years. Around 2.6 million people hold visas within the NRPF condition in 2022, and that's an increase of a million people in just 2 years. We've seen new cohorts of people who are now subject to the policy. We've seen a sharp increase of European nationals post-Brexit who are now subject to the NRPF policy. So it does impact a huge cohort of people. And why does it matter? Well, not everyone subject to NRPF is going to experience economic hardship, but it does mean that they're in a much more vulnerable position if their financial circumstances change, because they'll have no access to a welfare safety net. And we know that destitution across the UK is rapidly rising. The JRF estimate that it's doubled in just kind of 5 years, the number of people who are experiencing destitution. But we can't hope to kind of tackle or do anything to address destitution if we don't look at how migrants are impacted by the NRPF policy. We know that the migrants are disproportionately more at risk of destitution. It's 35% compared to the kind of average rate of people in the UK. And obviously destitution has a huge detrimental impact on people's lives, particularly when we're talking about children who are growing up in long-term deep poverty for their entire childhoods. But it also has a kind of real impact, this policy, on local authorities as well. Local authorities have a legal responsibility to support vulnerable people who are destitute and cannot access the mainstream welfare safety net. Now, it's only particular cohorts of people. It's families with children under 18 or very vulnerable adults with kind of care and support needs who are struggling to live independently. But local authorities themselves are under a huge kind of pressure already. They're operating on massively overstretched social care budgets, and they're seeing a huge rise in the number of families and vulnerable people approaching them in recent years. And they don't have the infrastructure, the resourcing, quite often the training to be able to kind of meet the demand or even kind of provide an adequate support or provision to families. And kind of most importantly, what we really heard in our recent research is actually what a humiliating and distressing experience it is for families and vulnerable adults trying to approach local authorities for support. So that's why it kind of matters in a nutshell.
That's obviously all fairly significant. Rupinder, if you could maybe give us a bit of a background to why the NRPF conditions actually exist in the first place. And obviously, Lucy's explained really that, I mean, NRPF conditions preclude people from accessing mainstream welfare and benefits. And that means that people find themselves in severe poverty and that responsibility falls on local authorities. Now, my former colleagues, Jonathan Price and Sarah Spencer, described this as creating a sort of parallel welfare state. That's a massive responsibility. I mean, can local authorities actually cope with this? And do you think that they have the skills and resources to provide this kind of support?
In terms of how the NRPF condition came about, I can probably speak to that a bit further in a bit. But, you know, we have a kind of history of exclusion baked into the British welfare state. So we can see that actually even from the inception of the National Assistance Act, which obviously happens after the war, but also actually even prior to that in terms of, you know, even as far back as the kind of early modern period where we have the poor laws and those that are both external to the country as well as people that are trying to move internally between countries can't access the support they need. And I think that's helpful to think about the kind of context in which this happens, but there's a really specific thing that's happening around no recourse to public funds now that that we need to speak about. So in terms of the issue around whether local authorities can actually deliver the support that's required of them and if they're set up in that way, there's been a lot of evidence being produced through local authorities themselves, which demonstrates that they're really struggling to provide this resource for people in terms of, you know, cuts to their budgets, the increasing demands on their resources. But also there's a cumulative impact of policy changes that have been made that impact on migrants, right? So we've got changes to immigration rules over the years. We have significant cuts to legal aid for migrants that were instituted from 2012 onwards, you know, often quite exponentially rising visa fees, the introduction of the NHS surcharge. So all of these have a cumulative impact of forcing families that are already impacted by no recourse to public funds into further destitution and further risk of quite deep poverty. I think it's also worth noting the kind of distinction of the people that are impacted by no recourse to public funds in particular. So we have people that have status as well as people that are undocumented. But obviously, entitlement to support is usually contingent on having status. But obviously, we can see, you know, all of these kind of things that I'm talking about, these bureaucratic processes, the kind of changes in law, the changes in policy also contribute towards creating undocumented status. Which I think is an important thing for us to note because, one, it moves us away from the sort of negative value judgments that we attach to people that are undocumented, right? Because we see how systems create this undocumented status, and it helps us to understand the really difficult situation that people are put in, you know, often because of factors that are outside of their control. So we've got this quite big cohort of people that are impacted by no recourse to public funds, both those that have status being in the country and can work and those that don't currently have status, possibly because of factors that are sort of outside of their control. So with all of that kind of context around how people are kind of being impacted by this status, how they're being produced as really vulnerable, it's also worth noting that, as Sarah and Jonathan have noted, we are also seeing the production and kind of huge need to scale up this parallel welfare state. So we've always had kind of aspects of the welfare state that are kind of devolved on a local level. We've got housing provision. But because of the wide scale application of the no recourse public funds condition, as Lucy has really helpfully laid out, particularly post 2012, particularly after we've left the European Union, we have the increase in the demand on this parallel welfare state. So taking the example of children's services teams, they have a legal duty to provide a whole range of support to children in need and their families. But much of this is focused on promoting children's welfare, And there's a statutory mechanism for that, which is laid out in the Children Act. We also have laws that lay out responsibilities for local authority in terms of supporting vulnerable adults. But what this need to resource this parallel welfare state does is it turns this child safeguarding duty and responsibility that's laid out in the law into more of a duty around the administrative allocation of actually fairly limited resource, which families need to survive because they can't access the welfare benefit system. And, you know, this is often in spite of families working, those that do have status, perhaps they're in low paid work, they're unable to access the top up benefits that they need. So the reality is this sort of parallel local welfare state is not set up in the same way as the centralised welfare state. Local authorities don't have the resource, they don't have the staffing, the capacity, the formalised structure and processes that a centralised welfare state has. And this is distracting from the local authority being able to deliver its functions. And I just finished by saying the backdrop for all of this is over a decade of austerity, which has meant that local authorities don't have the same budgets that they had, you know, 14 years ago or more. And also a context of decades of neoliberalism, which leads to the significant scaling back of the state's allocation of resource to even be able to support those that are in need, irrespective of their nationality and what their citizenship is.
Rupinder, thanks a lot. So, Anne, you're working with Oxford's Global Exchange on Migration and Diversity on this on the Understanding Migrant Destitution project, and you're doing it as what's called an expert by experience. Can you explain a little bit about what that actually means and how your experience has helped you to work with this and other projects? What sorts of things have shaped your understanding of NRPF and the associated support systems? And also just how people have to navigate this complex area in real life?
I would say expert by experience are people who have experienced these hardships themselves and they become expert with time. I have lived myself the struggles of immigration control as a migrant, and all the migrants live this life. And I cannot imagine how challenging it would be for people who suffer the tough realities of the system, going through no recourse to public fund, having immigration control and issues with local authority and stuff like that. I have been involved in a couple of projects where we strive hard to bring change, and also we are working with other people who have got the lived experience, and we want to change the system in a way that will be easily easily available for people. I work for a charity called NACOM, and over there I'm a community researcher. I've also been working in Migrant Voice Network. So in those organizations and charities, what we learn, we conduct the researches and we talk to vulnerable people, their experiences, their hardships and their challenges and how they navigate the system. And through those projects, I have learned research skills and also how to interview people. Then I used all those skills in this project at Oxford. What we did, we led focus groups and we interviewed people in those focus groups. We were involved in designing the questions and also how to use our questions with these people, because sometimes it's really sensitive talking to people living in those hardships and challenging lives. I would say it's really important to include lived experience people in these kind of work and researches, because we have deeper insights of the life what we are living. Like as a support worker or as a person from a charity or organization, like you can have an empathy or sympathy for what we have been going through, but you never know exactly how it feels. So in terms of dealing with people and clients, it would be really easy because of shared experience. They take us as peers, not as support workers. The level of fear is really, really minimized because they know that we have been through the system and their information will not be leaked to anywhere, maybe it's Home Office or any authority or anywhere else. So that changes the dynamic of research totally.
And that's all really, really important stuff. It's really, really fascinating to hear you sort of going through how people experience their interactions with researchers in that sort of way. Now, Lucy, if I can come back to you. So we've set out the situation broadly and some of the challenges that the system faces effectively. So I want to get to the real point of this discussion, which is what needs to change?
Well, we heard a really wide call from the different people we spoke to, and that includes local government, people with lived experience, frontline organisations, legal professionals, for a significant reform of the system, and including from many people a call to end the use of the NRPF condition. It's still early days in the kind of current government, so it's unclear whether that is something that is in scope. In the meantime, though, if local authorities are expected to provide this kind of safety net, it really needs to be resourced and receive the investment, the kind of training, the appropriate infrastructure to make sure that it's actually fit for purpose. And that's what our recent research kind of focused on, looking at kind of practical steps to how to make what's currently a very dysfunctional system actually fit for purpose. At the moment, many of those basics just aren't there, as we've kind of articulated. There are some pockets of good practice, but there's a lot of basics, for example, clear information on a website about where to seek help, or a clear policy on how much people should receive in terms of subsistence payments to be able to afford their kind of basic essentials, making sure that there's kind of decent housing. In many areas, none of that actually happens. And we know that local government is under pressure, without a doubt, but it really can do much better. And so therefore, we really need to make sure the local government is, in the first place, being resourced to deliver this. And so improving the kind of governance structures for tackling destitution. And quite often, migrant destitution is seen as a kind of very niche issue. NRPF is seen as something kind of really complex. But actually, local authorities need to understand that if they don't acknowledge it and they don't address it, it really impacts on wider priorities, such as ending homelessness or rough sleeping or trying to tackle child poverty or local public health inequalities. And so there really needs to be a much more joined up strategy to tackle migrant destitution within local government that's led at a senior leadership level. There also needs to be a kind of cross-government-wide strategy to also tackle destitution from a national perspective, mirroring some of the learning that we've seen in Scotland with their Ending Destitution Together strategy, which has kind of pulled together both national government, local government, the voluntary and community sector, but also really importantly involving people with lived experience as well in co-designing policy and practice that actually works. There are other recommendations that we've also kind of pushed for in our findings, where we've looked at also widening access to public funds to make sure that particularly those that are specifically focused on making sure that vulnerable people and children are able to receive support. So as Rupinder mentioned, things like child benefit, making sure that children aren't being punished because of their parents' immigration status, and that where there's benefits that have been specifically targeted for children, making sure that all children can access that, regardless of their or their parents' immigration status. But also through resourcing local government, we need to kind of empower them and fund them to, at a minimum, actually meet their legal responsibilities, which isn't happening at the moment in many areas. And ultimately, through kind of funding and resourcing and training, making sure that they're actually developing preventative approaches to tackling poverty and exclusion. And that, as I've mentioned, includes kind of resourcing local government, but also making sure that there's better statutory guidance that explains how to assess and support vulnerable people in need. There is guidance in Scotland and Wales, the statutory, however, seeing the kind of lack of how it's implemented shows that it probably does need to be reviewed. And there is no statutory guidance for England or Northern Ireland. So it really, central government need to kind of play a key role in making sure that that's implemented and drafted. Also, when we look at a local level in terms of subsistence policies, there needs to be clear statutory guidance with clear minimum acceptable rates that factors in people's needs and that also kind of draws on recent case law and guidance around that. And there really needs to be clear information and advice so people can access support locally, and so local authorities are kind of working in partnership with community organisations and immigration services to make sure that people can actually access adequate and specialist legal advice to support them. But I think one of the key findings we heard is that really there needs to be dignity and humanity at the heart of the system. As I mentioned before, it's an incredibly humiliating experience approaching local authorities. We heard from many people about the distressing stories they've had trying to seek support from local authorities. And so we really need to kind of draw on the findings from the Windrush Lessons Learnt review, which really calls for dignity and humanity to be at the heart of the system, to make sure that respect and dignity in how services treat people, and make sure that people follow principles of fairness and openness and effective care.
Lucy, thanks so much. Rupinda, I suppose the obvious question here is that, you know, like, both central government and local authorities have just a colossal number of competing demands and pressures on them. Is it actually realistic to imagine that either side is going to be willing to put in the effort and resources that are needed to resolving or improving the situation? And can you explain, I'm presuming, why you think that they should?
Yeah, I think on this question of political will, we know there's a lot of things that impact on whether there's political will, both on a national level and on a local level, including considerations around what sort of resource it requires, which group is in need of that resource, anticipating whether there'll be, you know, media or other backlash around implementing a particular change, and the complexity of the issue. And some of these issues seem immediately, it's immediately apparent why making the changes that Lucy's just outlined around no recourse to public funds would make sense, because there's a lot of people struggling. There's actually fairly straightforward solutions. There's been research that has found that if you do make welfare benefits available to people with no recourse to public funds, there's a long-term cost benefit, not only for those individuals, but in terms of their, you know, participation in the labour market, their ability to access support in terms of resolving long-term needs. Children have better health outcomes, better educational outcomes, all of these anticipated cost benefits. So on the face of it, certainly for those of us that have worked on this for a long time, it makes immediate sense that you should make these changes. But as I say, there's other things that shape political will. And then going back to what I'd said earlier about how we know migrants are framed, even, you know, we can make the arguments that a lot of these people have been here for a long time, their children are born here, often their children are British citizens. You can try and kind of make those arguments to push back against that, but we can see how it doesn't work because it's such an easy route to being able to scapegoat migrants and kind of malign them and make it easy to remove resources from them. So unfortunately, there's a sort of balance of a lot of different factors that shape political will around making these changes. That said, I think a lot of will does sit on the side of local authorities. And I think Lucy's really helpfully laid out that they need the resource to deliver some of these changes, right? There is ample data produced by the likes of the Local Government Association, London Councils and others around the significant dent to local authority budgets over the years. And we all experience that. I think another really important point that Lucy made is how supporting groups of migrants, such as those that are destitute, has a positive impact on all of us. So the arguments that we're making around resourcing local authorities better to be able to support destitute migrants is also an argument about having resource to, you know, collect our bins, to deliver basic functions in a community, to keep the libraries open. This is all about how we allocate social resource and who benefits from it, and that those of us with citizenship or precarious status are actually impacted by very similar things, even if the ways, the kind of sharp effects of those are faced differently by those that don't have status. So I think that's a really important point to make around how the conditions faced by migrants impact on all of us. And also, as Lucy laid out, in terms of access to health services, welfare support, homelessness, these are all larger issues that are impacting on those that are British at the same time as well. But what I would say is there is a lot of work happening around this. There's a lot of organisations that are doing work on this. You know, there are people working in Parliament, parliamentarians who see the sharp impact of this on their constituents, who've also been trying to raise this in their capacities, you know, within their political roles. We have a new government. It comes with a new set of political priorities. There is an opportunity to try and make the case for some of these things in that may not have existed in previous years.
Rupinda, thanks so much. Anne, you've had to cope with the challenges of the NRPF condition yourself, and you also work with other people who do. So, I mean, assuming that the government isn't going to grant access to the welfare state to all migrants in the UK at any point soon, What are the changes to the UK system that you think would make the most difference to people who are facing extreme poverty when they have no recourse to public funds?
I would say the first and the foremost thing is it is really, really important to understand it's not very easy for people to approach and ask for support. People in this situation, they are not here to enjoy the ease and welfare of the system. Maybe they have come from broken families, or maybe they have fled from war and those kind of situations. So they often feel humiliated and their dignity is hurt when system and workers disrespect people. They should be treated respectfully and with humanity regardless of their status. Another big bit is about child benefit. I think Lucy has also mentioned about that. There's a policy of every child matters. So every child matters should include each and every children. They should not be migrant children. They should not be children with NRPF. So child benefit is given to only those parents who qualify for recourse to public fund. It should not be like that. Regardless of parent status, whether they have NRPF or recourse to public fund, child benefit should be given to each child. They should not be locked out of support in this era of crisis and the cost of living. I would also say the information should be accessible to people on people's right. They should be made available in people's own language for better understanding. There should be more effort and more measures put in place when people are new in the country, whether they are educated, whether they are good in speaking English. That totally doesn't mean they understand the system and their rights. Another big bit is on the cost of Home Office fee, which is a couple of thousands of pounds for each person. So let's suppose a family of three or four, they have to save 3,500 something for each person every 2.5 years to secure their immigration status. So in this era where the cost of living is too high, where the expenses are too high, people cannot accommodate to live with the expenses. They can't afford the cost of everything. How could we imagine them to save up that much cost every 2.5 years? Maybe it's a single parent, and a parent and child have to submit 7,000 something fee every 2.5 years to the Home Office. And whether they have access of legal aid solicitor or not, which is another nightmare, then it's not really easy. It's not doable. It's really hard. This should have some consideration to change. I would also highlight that it's very important to listen from lived experience people, because they are the ones who have lived those challenges. They should be included in policy making places, so they could reassure that the policies which are made or changed, they are able to sense their needs.
That's fascinating stuff. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for talking to us. And so, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Jackie Broadhead.
And I'm Rob McNeil.